Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. This is our second podcast for April, and as we've been doing all year, this one is dedicated to the chronological history of Disneyland. Now, when we last left off, Jim had brought us all the way up through the early 1960s, right before the period where Walt started to get sick. So this episode, grab the Kleenex, kids. It's going to be the episode that covers 1962 to 1966, including Walt's death. In order to tell that story, and with a prescription of Xanax for all of us to stay happy, Mr. Jim Hill. How's it going, Jim?
It's going okay. And again, you know, just, you got to remember, this is a weird period in Walt Disney's life. I mean, yeah, we have the foreknowledge to know that in December of 66, Walt dies. But the weird thing is, when you pick up the story in late 62, early 63, this is Walt Disney firing on all four cylinders. This is a guy who virtually everything he does is, or everything he touches is turning to gold. And you know, again, forgive me for saying this in a Frozen kind of way. All right.
Really? That big?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, just to take a moment here, I know that there are people who are upset that, you know, it seems like, you know, every time they turn around, you know, something else at the Disney theme parks has become Frozen themed. But it's important to remember that even back in Walt's day, that when he had a success in a film or a TV show, it went into the parks. I mean, you know, take, for example, you know, Disney's Swiss Family Robinson movie opened in theaters in December of 1960. 22 months later, there's a Swiss Family Treehouse open for people, you know, to walk around in at Disney. And
wow.
This wasn't like shut down Maelstrom, gut the building, put a new ride in there, but keep the same ride system. This is a brand new building, a 60-foot tall artificial tree. It took 6 tons of steel, 110 cubic yards of concrete, 300,000 artificial leaves, you know, and just to make sure the thing didn't fall over, you know, the roots go down 42 feet and the branches reach out in 80 feet in different directions. And it was a success right from day one, except for the fact that they had made the leaves on the tree, just like the leaves on the tree in the movie, bright red, and found out the hard way that in the cruel Southern California sun, these things faded to pink in like 6 months. So it was the gay pride tree, Len.
That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that.
And it could just, you know, within, you know, a year or so, that they, you know, they had to put up the scaffolding and change out the leaves to a much hardier green that wouldn't burn down.
I didn't know that the leaves weren't always green. That's fascinating.
Well, you know, but again, that was the whole notion of Walt pointed to the tree in the movie and said, make one of those. And, you know, the Imagineer said, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir, and pink leaves. And
yeah, I was saying, in 22 months, they don't even have time to say, are you sure about the leaf color? They're essentially building as fast as they can.
And, you know, that's it exactly. And the weird thing, though, is that the construction of the Swiss Family Treehouse actually caused a ripple effect in Adventureland. In order to create a spot for this giant faux tree, they had to reroute the Jungle Cruise. And that meant moving the Indian Elephant Pool over to the Nile River. Likewise, you know, taking advantage of the fact that, you know, so much of this work was going on at the same time and these construction fences were going up. This is when Walt had the Enchanted Tiki Room built. And again, just to give you some idea of the way Walt worked during this period, you know, the Enchanted Tiki Room only became possible when there was a way to control audio animatronic figures. And as it turns out, the U.S. Navy had made the patent available for the system that controlled the Polaris missiles.
Oh, we talked about this in our, this is related to the World's Fair stuff.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk about in a little bit. Yeah, but this is the part where Disney lucks out by the U.S. government finally declassifying some World War II secrets.
Yeah.
Or Cold War era secrets.
And so for $17,000, Walt acquires the rights to use these to do in the park.
$17,000 for Polaris submarine technology.
You know, and the Russians are, why didn't we know? We got money. Damn it. Oh, you know.
It's the cost now of an entry-level Kia sedan.
There you go. But at the same time, you know, the what's kind of interesting, it's sort of a historic footnote, because you needed all of this technology. I mean, the whole bottom floor of the building was filled with tape drives and that sort of thing. This was actually the first attraction to be air conditioned at Disneyland, mostly because they had to keep all of the tape equipment downstairs cool. So, hey, come into the air conditioning that you just get by coincidental because we don't want all the tapes to burn up.
And that's,
but,
that's,
you know, from Walt's point of view, that's Tiki Room. But from Walt's point of view, he saw this as just a natural extension of everything he'd already done at this. You know, as Walt is quoted, whole 40 years at this point has been about, you know, showing the world how to make things move. You know, the, whether it's in our cartoons where we make inanimate objects move, or in our live action films where we do props. And now we're doing these dimensional human figures and animal figures. And it's all through electronics. And for him, what was so exciting, it's all programmed. It's all predetermined. It's this whole new dimension in animation that that's something we've been doing all our lives. But it's this new door, a new toy. And I love that Walt used the word phrase, a new toy. And we hope that we can really do some exciting things in the future. And knowing that it was the success of Tiki Room to actually open the door for shows like Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln or Pirates or Haunted Mansion. You know, the fact that this was the show that was sort of the proof of concept. But anyway, the double back to all of the construction that happened in Adventureland. And when you think, you know, all of this, you know, the tree, the Tiki Room, the rerouting of the river of Adventureland, you hear about that and think that in the modern Disney company, could they get all of that done in just 6 months? You know, I mean, that's... But to be fair here, it's important to remember that back during the 60s, and in fact, right up until Michael Eisner and company came through the door in the early 80s, during the winter months, Disneyland was actually closed on Mondays and Tuesdays. In fact, that's where the gag in National Lampoon's Vacation comes from. I mean,
the Musa French should have told you the place was closed.
That's it, exactly. I mean, there were a lot of tourists who came out from New England who weren't Southern California who drove up to Disneyland, and it's like on a Monday or Tuesday in the winter, what do you mean you're closed? But that seriously happened. But they were able to get so much work done during those 2 days when they could run heavy equipment into the parks and just get stuff done and set up. And then, you know, the other 5 days a week, you know, they could do the finish work behind the walls.
So what was in Adventureland? So they added the Swiss Family Treehouse.
Right.
They added the Tiki Room.
Mm-hmm.
What else was in Adventureland? It was just the Jungle Cruise?
Just the Jungle Cruise. Plus, of course, you know, you had your retail. And, you know, just a few months prior to the opening of Swiss Family Treehouse, they'd actually added the Tahitian Terrace, which a weird sort of bend on the story. The Tahitian Terrace and the Plaza Inn shared a kitchen. So, you know, to one side of the building, you're getting your classic American fare, you know, while, you know, coming out of the back of the building, you're getting skewers of meat and rice. And it kind of makes me think of what's going on at Universal Hollywood right now. They're just now in the middle of doing the soft opening of their version of Springfield, USA.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that their big food complex there, the one that features Cletus's Chicken Shack and Krusty Burger, they actually share a kitchen with the Three Broomsticks.
Really?
So, you know, I'd love to be, you know, inside of the Three Broomsticks at some point in the future and there be some sort of confusion and have somebody deliver me a clogger.
You know? We've mixed the streams. We've crossed the streams.
That's it, exactly. It would be a bad thing. But getting back to construction now, you know, Walt is able to control the construction inside the park. Outside of the park is now really becoming an issue. Take, for example, Jack Rather, the guy who built the Disneyland Hotel. And from 55 to 1960, thereabouts, this is all basically low-strung. Let's be honest. It's more a motel than a hotel. But it's selling out. So Jack wants to increase capacity, and he proposes building an 11-story tower that would face into the park.
So the Disneyland Hotel, as we know it now,
mm-hmm.
didn't exist?
No, not at all. I mean, again, first tower doesn't open until 1962.
Okay.
But again, you know, because Jack understands that Walt is a really good neighbor. I mean, think about it. You know, Walt paid, you know, $2.5 million to extend the monorail to the Disneyland Hotel.
Right, we talked about this. Because it was the right thing to do.
It was the right thing to do. But at the same time, so Jack wants to return the favor. So he goes to Walt and says, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. And Walt's like, wow, I don't know if I like that idea. And so Jack says, so like, I'll tell you what, how about this? Let's do a height test balloon. And then you and I will walk around inside of Disneyland and see where we can see it. And as it turns out, the only place you can really see the balloon just coming up over the trees is the sort of the southwesternmost corner of Frontierland, which eventually became where New Orleans Square was built. And so Walt says, okay, tell you what, can't see it anywhere else in the parks. I'm planning on building this New Orleans section. I'll make the streets tight. I'll make the buildings tall. Nobody's going to be able to see this. You go ahead and build your hotel. Again, that shows you the kind of guy that Walt is, that, you know, he was, because he respected that Jack was willing to do this balloon test. It's like, all right, I'm willing to work with you. However, not a lot of Disneyland's would-be neighbors were quite as cooperative as Jack. As Sam Genaway recounts in his 2014 unofficial guidebook, The Disneyland Story, well worth reading, folks. In late 1963, Sheraton West proposed building a $15 million, 22-story, 780-room hotel right at the corner of Ball Road and West Street. And this thing would have had a Pantot restaurant that looked straight into the park. Then in May of 64, Leo Friedman, the guy who actually built the Melody Tent, it was sort of a music theater that was right across from Disneyland, proposed building a 10-story office tower, a 5-story bank, and a public plaza with fountains right across the street from Disneyland's entrance. And then the one that finally kind of put Walt over the edge, Angel Stadium had been built at this point. And of course, the thing of a baseball stadium is you're only operating there during the times of year when people are playing baseball.
Yes.
And they wanted to get some additional revenue from this complex. So what they proposed is taking 4 acres of land and then building this $6 million, what was called the Angel Spire. The idea is it was modeled after Seattle's Space Needle. Would have, again, 750 feet tall, would have had a revolving restaurant, a cocktail lounge, and an observation deck on the top. You know, and this thing definitely would have been visible from inside of Disneyland. So at this point, Walt really felt that he had no choice, that all of these projects were coming down the pike and somebody had to do something.
Right.
Because it's, again, that, you know, it's Disneyland, the illusion of Disneyland or Disneyland's is fragile. I mean, I remember John Hench once talking about, the thing of Main Street USA when you're walking down listening to that, period music.
Yeah, the right time, yeah.
Yeah. If on the other hand, you put on Britney Spears, the illusion is shattered. You're suddenly pulled out of that, you're in that period. So Walt goes to the Anaheim City Council and says, look, I'm putting a lot of money into the local economy. I'd love some cooperation on this issue. It's just that I want to protect the illusion of Disneyland and, particularly people inside the park. So what Walt proposes is that properties that are directly adjacent to Disneyland be limited to 75 feet in height.
That's relatively low. That's what, like 4 stories, 3 stories and change.
There you go. Okay, now, any structure that's 1,800 feet away from, and the point they picked was the Plaza Hub, as in if you were standing in the very center of the park and you were looking out in all directions, anything that was 18,000 feet away from the center of the park.
18,000 feet?
Or, excuse me, 1,800 feet.
Okay, so about a third of a mile.
Third of a mile.
A little more than a third of a mile. Okay.
Had to be limited to 100 feet tall. At 2,200 feet out from the hub, a building could reach 125 feet, and then at 2,600 feet, basically half a mile. A hotel could go up to 150 feet tall. And the interesting thing is the Anaheim City Council actually got behind this. There was a unanimous 6-0 vote that got behind Walt's idea. So, Walt was grateful for that, but at the same time, he found himself blocked in the fact was he couldn't expand out into Disneyland's parking lot because during the summer it actually filled up on a daily basis. He couldn't go too far backstage because he needed things like, for example, the 6.5 acres that Owen Pope used for his pony farm for the car, the burros that were on the, Nature's Wonderland and the horses that pulled the main car. And at the same time, he'd drive into the park now. and see all the motels and the restaurants outside.
Yeah,
and
he couldn't buy the property anymore because it's too expensive.
Yeah, but he just, in fact, there's a quote, you know, from Walt that he wished that the area just outside the park didn't look like a second-rate Las Vegas.
Jeez.
So, you know, once you understand what he's dealing with and when he had to go to the city council, suddenly you understand the real appeal of Walt Disney World, where, again, they eventually ended up with 40,000 square acres with, you know, no visual intrusion for outside. Or, for that matter, the Mineral King project, where, you know, in a weird sort of way, Sequoia National Forest and the remoteness of the site of this proposed ski area served as the berm all unto itself. But yeah, Walt, this was just a fascinating time, you know, when you look at what Walt was up to. I mean, in the fall of 63, they're drawing up plans for Rogues Gallery, which is the walkthrough version of Pirates of the Caribbean. And they actually start construction. They dig the cellar hole where all of the show scenes are going to be put in. But that gets put on the back burner, you know, when Walt suddenly has to go all in on the 64 World's Fair.
So as late as 63, they're getting ready to build Pirates of the Caribbean. Oh, that's right, because wasn't it it was Pepsi, right? Who came to them and said,
"Yeah,
we'll get this thing in a few months. It's called the World's Fair. We need a pavilion."
That's it, exactly. So in a weird sort of way, it was Small World that stopped this version of Pirates being built. Bruce Gordon, the late great Imagineer, used to talk about how, you know, he would, you know, again, you want to talk about ironies, he would go up into the Swiss Family Treehouse, which had this supreme view of the Rogues Gallery construction site. And you could just go up and lean over the side and look in, and here was this giant cellar hole with bare steel. And it's like, you know, and he had all these Instamatic camera shots that he'd taken as a kid of, you know, he'd go up every couple of months, like, has it changed at all? You know, he'd have to go home and develop the film. I'm like, nope.
He's a little spy satellite.
Yeah.
You know, feet up in the tree. That's awesome.
But at the same time, you had things like, during this exact same period, John Hench, knowing that Walt's not happy with what's going on, you know, that the Tomorrowland is extremely dated, and this is something he's definitely going to turn and pay attention to after the World's Fair wraps, John starts putting together sketches for a thrill ride for Tomorrowland called Spaceport. And at this point, you know, John's idea is, instead of one roller coaster, it's four roller coasters intertwined. And, you know, your rockets are competing against one another as you come down, you know, through the mountain. And wow. In the end, one of the reasons this got put off for a full 10 years is that, you know, unlike what had happened with the Polaris missile system, there just was no technology that could control a roller coaster that was going to be this complex, you know, with four different launches the exact same time.
Right.
Again, during this period, you know, Walt is never busier. I mean, you know, for example, November 19th, 1963, it's the centennial of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and Walt and Robert Moses of they're flying to Illinois to meet with the governor there to do the official announcement that, you know, Great Moments of Mr. Lincoln is going to be sponsored by Illinois at the 64 World's Fair.
Wow.
They then, from there, they drop off Moses in New York, fly down to Orlando, and do the flyover of the proposed site for Walt Disney World. And again, in a weird little bend on the story, Walt makes the decision that's the site. They start to fly back to California. They stop in New Orleans to gas up the plane. And as they're getting off the plane, they find out that Kennedy's been assassinated. And, you know, and it just evidently, you know, just, you know, they had gone from this amazing celebratory mood in the plane, obviously, because, hey, we're going to build Walt Disney when we found the site, and just this somber flight back. But, you know, Walt, in the middle of it, you know, just made a point of saying, look, we're still going to do this. I mean, this is sad, but we're still going to do this. But again, it's important to understand here that this all came at a cost. All right. That Walt's attention on the theme parks and now expanding out, you know, the potential of the Disney theme park portfolio. You had, during this period, movies like The Sword and the Stone, which, if you take the Wizard's Battle out of that movie, is a pretty mediocre film. And if you talk to the animators who made it, they said, look, it was mediocre because we could never get Walt's attention.
Wow.
You know, he just wouldn't come to meetings. And, you know, and of course the irony is that if you actually look at Merlin in that movie, they got so mad that Walt wasn't coming to the meetings that they made Merlin's eyes and nose a caricature of Walt's, you know.
Just to piss off the Imagineers.
Yeah, and it's just, it was one of these things where the animators were, and he's gonna notice. At some point he's gonna notice. And he was so distracted, the entire movie got made and released into theaters before somebody clued him in, like, Walt, that's you. So, but again, this is a guy who, you know, is constantly tweaking and fixing his park. So in 64, right on the heels of, you know, having just plussed the Jungle Cruise by moving the elephant pool, he's putting a brand new scene in. This is the year that the trap safari with the you know, that the last guy there is going to get the, you know, get a point. Yeah. Or, you know, at the African Veld, this is when it goes into the Jungle Cruise. More to the point, you had, you know, people really wanting to be associated with Disney. So, for example, United Airlines sort of strong arms INA Insurance, which was the initial sponsor of Tiki Room. And it's like, thank you, get out of the way. And they become the sponsors of the Tiki Room. Likewise, you have the Astrojets. Those now suddenly are sponsored by American Airlines. And, you know, they had to they had to change the names of the Astrojets to the Tomorrowland Jets, because it turns out that there was another company using the word Astrojet that was in the airline industry, and it was like, if you want our money, you're going to have to get that name off of there.
Huh.
But anyway, all right. As you mentioned earlier, you know, this is the year, you know, April 22nd, 64, the New York World's Fair opens. Walt is behind four of the five most popular attractions at the park.
Yep.
You know, you then jump ahead to August 27th, 1964. Mary Poppins comes out. So you think of that as a 1-2 punch, all right? You know, Walt is now basically at the center, you know, the white hot center of American pop culture. You know, this is a guy who can, you know, the guy behind Disneyland, the guy behind Mary Poppins, the king of the fair. He can do no wrong. And
he's on both coasts now. He's on East Coast, West Coast, and the New York media market's huge at this point. So, okay.
But here's the amazing part. This is from an interview in the Saturday Evening Post, November 1964. And, you know, so it's talking about, what is Walt Disney up to after this? And, you know, so as it turns out, according to this article, he's about to rehabilitate the St. Louis waterfront with a new multi-million-dollar Disneyland-type establishment under a 3-acre roof. He's considering a proposal to erect an amphitheater at Niagara Falls that will dramatize the spectacle of the falls in all four seasons. And this one, again, I've never heard reference to this project before, Len. But he has staggering plans underway for a huge amusement park in Japan that will recreate the various periods of that country's history. November 64, and this is not the Tokyo Disneyland deal. That doesn't start to bubble up till 1974, and even then it's not officially announced in 1978. So this is an entirely different project. But at the same time, Walt is never happier, never healthier. You know, this is a guy who, you know, who works a full solid week at the studio and goes over to WED, and then, but on Friday night, he drives down to Disneyland because, you know, as he put it, Disneyland was a dream that I had for 20 years. It made me feel good the day it opened. With a picture, it's finished once you're filmed and edited, but Disneyland's not finished yet. You can change Disneyland and make it better. You can't do that with a picture, and boy, we're really changing things at Disneyland. this is a interview with the Chicago Tribune in January of 65. So this is just as the park is getting ready for its tencennial. That's what they call Disney's 10th anniversary celebration of the tencennial. And it, you know, if you look at the numbers, you know, Disneyland in its first year of operation, 55 to 56, had 3.8 million visitors. By 65, it had climbed to 6.4, and the following year would bump up to 6.7 million. And so Walt, you know, it was just one of these things where it's like, you know, I'm going to celebrate. So just that year, they spent just under $1 million on special entertainment for the 10th annual celebration. And he followed that up by spending $250,000 just on Disneyland's Christmas parade.
I was right, because they had started doing Christmas late.
Yeah.
We did a show in this, late 50s, early 60s?
It's actually early 60s is when they began to really get – I mean, you know, they had a Christmas in Many Lands thing that they did in 59, 60, but they really got serious about it. They began to recognize that the Southern California locals – we're now coming out to see the decorations, and this was becoming sort of a holiday treat for the locals. So they're like, okay, let's give them a reason to come out.
Wow. So Walt in 1965 is spending $1 million on special entertainment.
Yep.
And that's $7.5 million in today's dollars.
And again,
just, that's a lot.
That, and just, again, for 1 year's worth of entertainment. Just
that's
to
20
give,
grand a day.
Yeah. Yeah. And... you know, and meanwhile, in July of 64, during a celebratory meeting with the team that had launched the park, he revealed that they had plans to pour another $40 million into the park over the next 5 years. And as he put it, our objective is to keep the park always fresh, not just through rehabilitation, but through constant change, improvements, and additions. And, yeah, I mean, the man was as good as his word. You know, that if you think about that, when Disneyland opened in, 55 with 22 attractions, mm-hmm. By 65, we're at 47 attractions.
Wow.
And at the same time, good wasn't good enough with Walt. I mean, you know, for example, they had the Red Wagon Inn that had sat there at, on the plaza for years. And, Walt wanted that changed out to the Plaza Inn. And so, you know, he sends John Hench off to restaurateur school so he can learn about what a good, you know, how you build a great restaurant.
Wow.
And so, you know, he comes back and he has this idea to create an open sky restaurant with the first look-in kitchen that's ever been done in a theme park environment. And the end price for this plush Victorian style restaurant, you know, end cost was $1.7 million. Now, when you figure that the park itself cost $17 million back in 55, and he's spending a tenth of that amount just on one restaurant now, I mean, that just kind of gives you, you know, Walt's attitude toward money. And again, I want to put this quote out here because it's, you know, as we move forward, this is going to, you know, kind of echo in a weird sort of way. Walt said once, money is something I understand only vaguely. And think about only when I don't have enough to finance my current enthusiasm, whatever that may be. All I know about money is I have to have it to do things. I don't want to bank my dividends. I'd rather keep my money working. I regard it as a moral obligation to pay back borrowed money. When I make a profit, I don't squander it or hide it away. I immediately plow it back into a fresh project. I have very little respect for money as such. I regard it merely as a medium for financing new ideas. I neither wish nor intend to amass a personal fortune. Money or the lack of it to carry out my ideas may worry me, but it doesn't excite me. Ideas excite me.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
Yeah, and so, you know, you get to, I once got to talk with Sam McKim, who was the guy who actually helped do a lot of design and great moments with Mr. Wink. And he said, look, we followed Walt's philosophy to the letter. You know, I mean, he didn't even want them raising the price of parking at the park, which stayed at 25 cents for years. You know, he didn't mind making money off the park, but he didn't want to make money off of the parking. He wanted to give the public a good deal. And, you know, so, you know, when you think about it, and speaking of great moments with Mr. Lincoln, think about this, Len. Great moments when it opened in the park in the summer of 65 and for years afterwards was free to anyone under 17 years of age. You didn't Wow. have to pay to go into this thing. And when you think about they did 60 shows a day, you know, how much money, you know, that was, you know, Yeah. just off the table because that, you know, Walt felt like this was a show that kids should see. Meanwhile, you know, just again, because Walt wanted to be a good neighbor, I think one of my favorite, you know, aspects about that is they used to allow the Anaheim police to climb up into the Matterhorn during drive time, you know, during the morning rush hour and the afternoon rush hour. They actually had a traffic cop up there with binoculars.
Really?
Looking out on the 5. And when the traffic would, you know, he'd get a hold of the motorcycle guy, and it's like, all right, go to the corner of this and this. There's a backup.
That's great.
So, but again, for Walt, again, this is, you know, as I mentioned, that Disneyland was the dream, you know, that something he'd wanted to do. But as the outside world began to encroach, you know, he began looking for bigger and better dreams. So, you know, we jump ahead to October 20th, 1965, when the Orlando Sentinel reveals that, you know, we think we found out who's buying up all the swampland in Orange County and Osceola County, and it's Walt Disney. And, you know, Walt, because he's finally outed, November 15th of 65, ends up down at the Cherry Plaza Hotel in Orlando with his brother Roy and then Governor Hayden Burns. And, you know, that's when they first revealed the Florida Project. And, which again, you think about it, 40,000 square acres, you know, that would have been enough for any man, you know, to yeah, you know, that'll keep you occupied for a while. But no.
Anything beyond that, and you're really looking at sort of like, you know, nation state level of land.
Well, but 6 weeks later, Disney, the Forest Service, announces that they have awarded the rights to develop the Mineral King area of Sequoia National Forest to Walt Disney Productions. And, you know, so it's like that now these two huge projects that, you know, Walt and the Imagineers have got to shepherd. And meanwhile, the 64 World's Fair has shut down, so the shows are starting to march back. Now, I mean, think about it. Remember, World's Fair closes in October of 65.
Yep.
By May of 1966, Small World is opening at Disneyland. All right.
Was the park at this point still closed 2 days a week?
Yeah. So, you know, it was somewhat easier. In fact, at the Thea summit I was at earlier this month, they were talking about what actually made it easier to bring a lot of the sets and costumes back from New York is the fact that so many of the sets were just hinged. I mean, when you walked around the backside, they were plywood with little hinges screwed in them. And so, you know, you could fold them up and ship them back to Anaheim in just a week or so. But yeah, they had a huge event on May 28th, 66. There was kids from 16 different ethnic groups, you know, officials from 36 different consulates and over 800 members of the press. And again, in a not exactly eco-friendly gesture, 100,000 balloons were released as the attraction opened.
Filled with, DDT, apparently.
There you go.
It was a propellant. Everyone was doing it back in the days.
There you go. All right. And then right behind this, 6 weeks later, Primeval World opens. And so that's got...
This is late June, early July?
Yeah, that July 1st. And so, you know, so this is 46 of the AA figures that have been done for Ford's Magic Skyway. I mean, Walt decided he really didn't care for the way that the cavemen looked, but he loved the dinosaurs. So they came back and they set them up, you know, just between Tomorrowland and Main Street USA in a brand new building there. And if this wasn't enough, okay, 3 weeks later, New Orleans Square opens up. And, you know, this is a $15 million, you know, version of a pre-Civil War New Orleans.
Wow. So $105 million in today's dollars.
Yeah. And you know, and this is all, and this is all happening because, again, Walt isn't taking any money out of the park. He's just pouring it straight back in.
Yeah.
But that said, there are warning signs that things are not, you know, things are not entirely right with Walt. You know, in fact, just 5 days after New Orleans Square opens, there's a movie that opens in theaters, a Dick Van Dyke film that Disney did called Lieutenant Robinson Crusoe, USN. And back in 65, there were scenes for this that Disney shot on a U.S. aircraft carrier that and, you know, the captain of the boat, you know, just like, look, you know, Mr. Disney, we'd be honored if you and Mr. Van Dyke would stay on the boat while you're shooting the scene. So that it, as it turns out, Dick and Walt shared a stateroom, and Dick tells this story about, you know, Walt just had this horrible cough. And, you know, in the middle of the night, you know, multiple times Walt got up and went to the sink and ran ridiculously hot water and then would sort of slap it back down on his neck for what he thought was a polo injury that he'd had in the 30s. It hadn't healed properly. But Dick is pretending to be asleep and just watching, you know, how much pain this guy is dealing with every day.
Yeah.
And it was just sort of like, and the fact that he gets up the next day and is just, you know, this charming guy and dealing with all of the sailors and, you know, thrilled to be, you know, on the boat and curious about how an aircraft carrier operates. And it's just, you know, just that he could keep going on that little sleep and in that rough shape. But again, Walt pushes on. September 18th, 1966, he's up in the woods of just outside of Sequoia National Forest for the Mineral King press conference, where they first show the art of the ski area. And they, you know, at that point, you know, people were noticing that Walt was having trouble breathing, but they attributed it to the high altitude. They, you know, they're way up there in the mountains. And it's only, you know, in November where he's like, you know, this polo injury is killing me. I gotta get looked at. So he goes across the street to St. Joseph's Hospital and they run some tests and, you know, eventually they're like, we might need to do some exploratory stuff here. And
this is November of 66. Is that late?
It's that late. All right. And, they cut him open. And they find cancer. They particularly find, you know, and they have to take out almost, you know, better than half of his right lung. And they sew him back up. And I know this is going to sound strange by today's standards, but they didn't tell him. They told Roy and they told Lillian and they confided in them. They thought he had a year, maybe two. But they were going to, you know, let's get right on this. Let's start cobalt treatments. Let's, you know.
Cobalt, radiation.
Radiation. We're going to get right on this. And so Walt goes back to work. And, in fact, it's.
He's got to know something, though, right?
Well, that's what's interesting. He starts doing. Again, we have the luxury of, you know, 40 plus years after the fact to sort of look at what he did during this period. And it was basically a victory lap. He went around and, you know, visited with folks without making it obvious that he was saying goodbye, but he was saying goodbye. You know, for example, he went down to the set. They were shooting Blackbeard's Ghost at that time. And so this is a Dean Jones, Peter Ustinov movie. In fact, you know, Walt was really excited because Peter had already committed to doing Khrushchev at Disneyland, that they were going to, I think we've talked about this in on earlier shows about
Khrushchev at Disneyland. Yeah.
Yeah. And Suzanne Plachette is there on the set, you know, and she's playing, you know, Dean Jones's love interest. And she was very, she was very fond of Walt. I mean, you know, that she felt that she owed a lot of her career to Walt Disney. In fact, she was in a Universal film called 40 Pounds of Trouble. This was the first time Walt had ever allowed anybody to shoot a movie at Disneyland.
Wow.
This is very much worth checking out, folks. I think it's available on Netflix or through the Universal kind of on-demand stuff. But it's this great snapshot of what Disneyland was like in 61-62. But Walt had so enjoyed her work in this, this is a Tony Curtis film, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But she's the love interest in that. He enjoyed her so much, he immediately, once they finished working on that movie, he had the studio hire her for, The Ugly Dachshund, which was the first, which these days people know because it was the film that the Winnie the Pooh featurette was sent out into the world in. And, you know, that's the first time anybody saw Disney's take on Winnie the Pooh. But, you know, Walt was just, he just loved how funny she was and edgy. And so, you know, he we're going to put Suzanne in this. And so he shows up on the set. And she's just doing everything she can to amuse him and tease him and make him seem like it's, you know, things are just the same the way they always are. But he is yellow and he's lost. You know, it looks like they cut you know, 40 pounds off of the guy, and he just looks terrible. And soon as she finishes teasing and playing with him, she goes back to her trailer and just bursts into tears. And in fact, they pretty much, you know, once he left the set, it's like, okay, we're done for the day. You know, nobody
done. Yeah.
Could work, because it's like, he's in trouble. And then he goes over to Imagineering. And so he's visiting, you know, he just sort of wandering down the hall at, you know, over in Glendale, and ends up in Mark Davis's office. And here's Mark working on the show that's supposed to go into Mineral King, the nighttime entertainment, which is about this bunch of silly bears that have come out of the woods and grabbed instruments and are playing.
It'll never work.
Never work. And Walt is just loving the drawings, and you know, so he's, you know, just gets up to leave, and he stands in the doorway for a moment and says, well, goodbye, Mark, and leaves. And it's like, this is a guy who never said goodbye in his life. He just got up and moved to the next thing. And Walt, you know, and Mark just sort of sat there in the office big-eyed and got on the phone immediately to his wife Alice, and it's like, he's dying.
Oh, jeez.
You know, and sure enough, he goes back into the hospital. He and Lillian fly out to Palm Springs with the hope that the desert weather and the lack of humidity will make it that much easier on him. But he has a collapse out there. They have to take him back to St. Joe's. And it's obvious he's spinning in, you know, and, you know, Roy spends, you know, the night of December 14th in the room with him. And Walt is laying in the hospital bed, pointing up at the ceiling tiles, going over his plans with Roy about what he wants built where at Walt Disney World. So the next morning, you know, it looked like he was rallying. It looked like he might make it. And so the next morning, here comes Diane Disney Miller and her husband Ron, you know, come to St. Joe's, and, you know, Diane stops from home to get a drink, and Ron goes into Walt's hospital room, and then literally sort of backs out of the room as if he's been pushed, you know, just with this huge stunned look on his face. And what he's seen is Walt dead in bed. And there's Roy at the end of the bed, and just sort of, you know, stroking his brother's foot, just sort of, you know, just sort of talking to him about, because Roy was undone in a lot of ways, because you have to understand that Roy had announced earlier in, you know, took Walt aside in late 65, early 66, look, I want to retire. You know, I'm 71, 72. You know, and it's time. I want to take Edna. I want to travel. I want to spend time with my grandkids. And Walt was like, no, sure, you've earned it. You know, and the company's doing great, and let's find somebody to replace you. And so, again, you have to understand that, you know, so he's in the process of doing that till the doctors call him in November from St. Joe's and come over. And it's just sort of like, and here's his baby brother, the guy he protected his entire life.
And,
you know, and there's nothing he can do. And so, you know, and Roy, as a gesture on the night of the 14th, you know, while he's sitting there talking, you know, he actually calls over to the studio and tells them, from Walt's bedroom, he can see the studio. So he has them turn on every light in the building. You know, so, you know, Walt can see what he built, what he did, you know.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
So anyway, we're not going to get into the whole Frozen nonsense. I mean, you know, from talking with Disney family members, you know, that Walt isn't sharing a room with Clarence Birdseye. Okay, this was a small private ceremony. The body's buried at Forest Lawn. It was done privately because Walt didn't like funerals. You know, Walt. Yeah. You know, and Roy respected those wishes, but, you know, and a week went by, and everybody in the company, you know, because then, you know, 99.9% of the people in the company didn't know Walt had any health issues. In fact, when the word got out to Disneyland, I mean, Tony Baxter talked about, he was driving in to Disneyland. He was working as a cast member at that time. And, you know, just driving into Disneyland, heard on the radio that Walt Disney had died. And it was just like, no, there's no way that he could be dead. And just pulled into the cast member parking lot and could see from the car them lowering the flag, inside the park. And, you know, the irony is that he goes in, he picks up his check and gets his 1-year pin. Cause, you know, that day.
Oh, really?
But there was this huge discussion in within the company, because I mean, going back to when Kennedy was shot, the Saturday that, you know, the country was in mourning, Disneyland closed. I mean, there was actually a sign out front and an employee who explained, you know, we're in deference to what's going on, we're closed for the day. And there was this huge discussion about Walt died. Should the park be open? And it was actually Dick Nunes who argued, it's like, look, Walt was always about doing right by the public, and people have driven here. And,
yeah,
you know, just because he's dead doesn't mean the show doesn't go on. So they kept the park open. And, in fact, that's, you know, again, 1 week after Walt died, Roy brings a group of company executives together into a projection room at the studio and just flat out says to them, it says, look, I'm postponing my retirement, and we're going to finish this park in Florida, and we're going to do it just the way that Walt wanted, and don't you ever forget it. I want every one of you to do exactly what you'd do if Walt was alive.
Wow.
And, you know, that's both a good thing and a bad thing. But we'll get to that in our next installment of the Chronological Disneyland.
Wow, great, great ending, Jim. That's so fantastic. Oh, fantastic. All right, you've been listening to another edition of the Unofficial Guide to Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. Please go into iTunes and Stitcher and rate our show. Also, tell your friends, even people you kind of just like or you've just met on subways. Also, tell us what kinds of shows you'd like to hear next. Jim and I are always looking for new adventures. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.